Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right. This is Ida History, and I am Jeff Wade, one of your hosts, sitting with my co-host, Mr. Mark Golddigger Iverson. What's going on, Mark?
You know, just hitting the gents up for a little bit of gold. What? Gold digger? What are you talking about?
Talking about digging for gold on this episode.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was a reference to Wyatt Earp, you know, because that was also about digging for gold. And some silver, I think.
Kanye West reference.
Well, you know, he is my favorite whacked out rapper.
Okay. Right. Mark, why don't you tell our listeners what we're talking about today?
Well, let me read this passage from the South Idaho Press, dated June 29th, 1939. It has been said, and with probable truth, that women have played a part in every historical event of importance. A Nez Perce woman is credited with being a principal factor in the discovery of gold in Idaho. Courageous Jane Silcott likely forwarded the development of Idaho by a decade or more. Possibly it was Jane Silcott, daughter of a Red chieftain, born and raised in the Idaho wilderness, who turned the tide of victory in the Civil War, since gold from the Clearwater country provided the sinew for the Union treasury.
Yeah, I really like this episode because we're going to talk a lot about the first gold find in Idaho, or the first major gold find, I should say. And I wanted to learn more about that, but there's this whole story about Jane Silcott that's going to go along with it. But before we get into it, Mark, why don't we do a couple of announcements? First of all, I would like to ask, beg, implore our listeners, if you like what we're doing, you can help us out by, you know, leaving a review on iTunes or wherever your podcasts are coming from. Also, share what we're doing, share our episodes, share our social media posts with your friends, your family. Tell your cat, especially if your cat's a social media influencer. Helps out. I mean, Mark, we're trying to grow this thing. We're trying to tell these stories that are important to Idaho's history that haven't really been told or haven't been told in this way before. So if people could help us out, we'd be eternally grateful.
I find, you know, it doesn't just have to be cats. I see rodents. I see, well, beavers. They're a rodent, but I see beavers getting lots of views, goats. Whatever. We'll take it. Yeah, we have some other stuff going on too. Our book, we have mentioned this, you know, is coming out September 25th and it's Haunted Boise. We're going to have book signings at places. What, CUNA, right, Jeff? Book Habit place, right? And where else?
We're working on one at Rediscovered Books. Their only location now, sadly, the Caldwell store closed. And then we've got a lot of things going on in October. So just stay tuned. Watch our social media. We'll be listing all those out. But Mark, why don't you tell us some people about the tours we got going on?
Yeah, so we have, of course, our macabre History of Boise walking tour. We have the Boise True Crime 1970s van tour that's coming out. We have some other things, you know, in the oven we're working on. We're baking up right now. And Jeff, are you going to be doing any of your macabre Napa tours?
I am. I haven't scheduled them quite yet. Probably here in the next week or so, I'll get some Napa tours on the schedule.
Oh, and we're excited because we're going to be doing some Halloween content coming up here, you know, and going to our friends at the Crescent Brewery in Nampa, doing a podcast there and seeing what ghosties we can stir up. We're going to go out to Mountain Home and talk to a friend of ours out there that lives in a historic apartment building that's supposedly haunted. And we're going to talk about the connection between hauntings and history and how enjoyable they are when they're combined. So we got a lot of fun stuff coming out, and we're going to be on Lectures by Lushes or Lushes Lectures or something like that, and it's going to be at Mad Swede Brewing on October 20th around 7 p.m. So do get tickets for that or go buy them at the door, whatever.
Yeah, that'll be a fun time. We'll be a little tipsy probably by the time we're done with that. It's kind of the point, right?
I hope so. Yeah, you get an hour to drink before we present, yeah. Which I like.
Heck yeah. But like we said, follow our newsletter. You can find that on our website. And then social media, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest. No, we're not on Pinterest.
Tinder? Sure. Oh, wait, no. Never mind. Okay. Sure. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. You got anything else on announcements, or should we get into this?
I think we should get into the meat of the story, Jeffrey.
Excellente. All right. So our central figure of our story today is a lady named Jane Silcott, but that wasn't the name she was given by her parents. Jane was born Khoi Nu around 1842 on Alpawa Creek, which dumps into the Snake River just a few miles west of the Idaho-Washington border, so near Clarkston, Washington, and Lewiston, Idaho, that area. She was the daughter of Tamatsu, who's the chief of the Alpawa band of the... Mark, help me out with the proper name for the Nez Perce.
Nimepu? I'm sure I did a poor job of that, but then it... I think that's basically the gist of it. And, you know, we call the Nimepu the Nez Perce. Fur trappers, white fur trappers came up with that one because they said they pierced their nose, but I don't recall the Nez Perce piercing their nose, but I'm no expert. But anyway.
There were some bands that did, and that's what the trappers, they were the first ones to meet those bands, so that's how they got the name. Now, the term Nimepu actually means the people in the Nez Perce language, though we have a lot of Nez Perce names that we're going to be talking about tonight. We're probably going to mess them all up, so not to disrespect the Nez Perce, but we wanted to make sure we at least try their traditional names. Just don't want to leave that out.
Well, you did pretty good there from what I heard, but we got a lot to go, I'm sure, so we'll see how we do. Moving on, Tamutsu, or Tamotsin, was the son of Chief Joseph. That's old Chief Joseph, the Nez Perce leader who greeted Lewis and Clark when they walked into present-day Idaho via the Lolo Pass in August of 1805. Tamotsin was just about a year old when his father helped the Corps of Discovery as they were about to starve to death. On their return trip, the white men again camped with the Nez Perce. Out of all the tribes they visited on their journey, it was the Nez Perce that they spent the most time with.
Tamotsin grew up hearing the story about his father helping the white man, and was taught to do the same should he ever be in that same situation. In 1836, two missionary couples, Henry and Eliza Spaulding, and Narcissa and Marcus Whitman, arrived to set up missions among the natives of the Pacific Northwest. The Spauldings set up their mission at Lapway among the Nez Perce, while the Whitmans set up theirs near Walla Walla and the Cayuse.
And it all went splendidly. Oh, wait, sorry, I'm jumping the gun. Tamotsin greeted the Spauldings with open arms and became their first convert. Henry Spaulding baptized the chief and gave him the Christian name Timothy, and Khoi Nu took on the name Jane. Timothy really embraced Christianity and agriculture and learned how to read and write, but tragedy came to the missions when the Cayuse attacked the Whitman mission on November 29th, 1847, killing Marcus, Narcissa, and 11 others. They also took around 50 women and children captive, including 11-year-old Mary Ann Bridger, the daughter of famous outdoorsman, mountain man Jim Bridger. You know, and as well as they took captive the Spaulding's 10-year-old daughter, Eliza, as well. From what I understand, Jeff, though, that the reason the Whitmans were attacked, there were some real reasons behind that, right?
There were, and we want to do an episode on this, but basically, Dr. Whitman was able to heal measles among the white people who had antibodies for the measles, but the Cayuse and the Nez Perce didn't have these antibodies, and so they were suffering much higher fatality rates, and so because of that, they felt they saw Dr. Whitman as a medicine man, and if a medicine man fails to do what he's supposed to do, they were subject to death.
Yeah, and there was also some other stuff that was going on, some bad politics, some bad mojo between the tribes. Yeah, and so it was, but regardless, yeah, it didn't work out.
But you had mentioned Eliza Spaulding, the 10-year-old daughter of the Spauldings. She had been staying at the Whitman Mission during the time of the attack. She was learning, I can't remember what, she's taking certain classes or she's learning certain things there. But when Timothy heard that Eliza was missing, he made it his mission to get her back. He also sent some members of his band to help track down and punish tribe members responsible for the attack. The captives ended up being taken to a Hudson Bay Company trading post where they were actually ransomed or basically purchased by Peter Skeen Ogden, the noted trapper for which Ogden, Utah is named for.
Yes, sir. So the Whitman Massacre did not do anything to stem the migration to the Oregon country. The Oregon Trail, which the Whitmans and Spauldings helped pioneer, and the Donation Land Claim Act, which allowed people to get some of that sweet, sweet free land in Oregon, meant an influx of white settlement butting up against the traditional Nez Perce lands. In 1855, Washington Territorial Governor Isaac Stevens called together all of the Nez Perce headmen to negotiate a treaty.
The 1855 treaty was the first of three treaties that the U.S. government signed with the Nez Perce, and the only one signed by all 56 bands of the tribe. Simply put, the Nez Perce ceded about 7.5 million acres of borderlands in exchange for the ability to hunt and fish whenever, wherever they traditionally did. And then they were also supposed to get annuity payments and buildings such as mills and schools to be built on the reservation by the government. It also restricted whites, except for the Indian agent and 13 employees, from entering the reservation for any reason. And it was Chief Timothy who helped translate and negotiate for this treaty.
Timothy again helped in 1858 when Colonel Edward Steptoe's 164-man company was attacked and trapped by a combined force of 1,000 natives of the Coeur d'Alene, Spokanes, and Palouses during the Spokane-Coeur d'Alene Palouse War at the Battle of Pine Creek. Under the cover of darkness, Timothy led Steptoe and his men to safety.
Coming up on the 1860s, the Nez Perce bands were very much in disagreement with how to approach the encroaching white settlements. The 1855 treaty would not be ratified until 1859, meaning the government provided none of the payments or other benefits they promised the Nez Perce. Meanwhile, white settlement was growing on the lands the tribe had ceded, meaning the natives had kept their promise, but the government had not. Many Native Americans obviously believe that their land was stolen because of shit like this.
Right, and some may in fact say that it was, right? Because it kind of was. But yeah, the Nez Perce is kind of a great example of that, right? It's like, oh, okay, we get this nice tree, we get this big swath of land, not what it was before. And then it's like, wait, nope, we found gold, right? Isn't that essentially what happened? And oh, we got to put you all in this little compact area, right? Uh-huh. Maybe, yeah. I'm wrong. So the disagreement between tribal leaders on how to deal with the white men led to two factions being created. Timothy, along with, oh my goodness, Ha Ha Told Trot, or Chief Lawyer. Oh yeah, Chief Lawyer. Do you know how to pronounce that traditional language name there, buddy?
I think you did great.
Okay. Well, Chief Lawyer, he was the most leading kind of vocal voice of the pro-American side or the pro-treaty factions of the Nez Perce. Alalimia Takanin, or Chief Looking Glass, and Tipyahalana Kapu, or Chief Eagle from the Light, were among the anti-treaty light leaders. They opposed any further settlements by whites or trade with them. Some anti-treaty bands even pushed for war with the American.
So we're going to do we actually talked about trying to figure out how to do a Nez Perce War episode. It's going to have to be like three episodes long. And so we're trying to approach that. But basically what we're talking about right now lays the groundwork for the 1877 Nez Perce War, or Flight of the Nez Perce, as it's also called.
Right. Yeah. And it's such a unique story for a war, especially because it was a running battle. Essentially one big long running battle that had these big moments of firefights, and larger conflict. But it's a really interesting tale. But anyway, Jeff.
While all of this was going on, rumors among the miners and prospectors in the West started to surface that there was gold to be found on the Nez Perce lands. In 1856, a man named Martin was traveling the Nez Perce Trail, and he panned some gold on the South Fork of the Clearwater River. The next year, a trapper named Jack Le Sieur found some gold on Orofino Creek, which is a tributary of the North Fork of the Clearwater. One prospector who paid particular attention to these rumors was Elias Pierce. He was a Mexican-American war vet who had also mined during the California and British Columbia gold rushes. Back in 1842, Pierce claimed to have worked as a trader with the Nez Perce, and during that time, he panned gold on the North Fork of the Clearwater. He decided not to pursue it at that time because of the danger from the Nez Perce. There is also this long-standing story that a Nez Perce man once had a dream where the Great Spirit led him to the side of a mountain and revealed to him a great golden ball stuck in the side of the rock. In his dream, the Nez Perce man tried to get the gold out but was not successful. Now, this is kind of a romantic version in that says Pierce was trying to prove this dream real, but in reality, it was pretty much clear that Pierce just wanted to get rich off the gold.
Pierce returned in 1858 and started trying to figure out how to prospect on the reservation. Many whites in the area knew that attempting to trespass on Nez Perce lands meant risking open war with the Nez Perce, but it was also accepted that it would happen sooner or later. Others were looking forward to the business that a gold rush in eastern Washington Territory would bring. Pierce decided that he would be the guy to start it.
Do we need to explain that at this point, that this was Washington Territory, Idaho Territory? You want to be created for another, 4 years?
You want to explain it?
I think I just did.
Oh, you did? Oh, yeah. I thought you were asking me if you wanted to.
That's good. That's all right. I'll cut it. Don't make it make sense.
Okay. All right.
Pierce, along with 25-year-old Seth Farrell, left Walla Walla for the reservation on February 12, 1860. They were dressed as traders and had their prospecting equipment hidden. When they reached the Clearwater, they camped with Walla... When I was writing this, I had it all in my head, how I would say these.
Ah. Okay. Yeah.
When they reached the Clearwater, they camped with Wislaniqua, one of the chiefs who was friendly to the whites. Pierce and Farrell were honest about their intentions, and they even took the headman out with them to one of the bars on the river, and Pierce panned and he found a bit of gold, which is about 3 to 5 cents a pound.
That's not a lot of gold, but it was enough to indicate there could be a richer find further up in the mountains. Pierce and Farrell panned for a few more days, finding gold everywhere they looked. On February 26, they headed back for Walla Walla for supplies. Pierce met with A.J. Kane, Indian agent, and reported his find, but he lied and said the gold was found east of the reservation. Kane warned Pierce that if he did enter the reservation to prospect, it could set off a war. Pierce, of course, ignored the warnings.
So they tried again. On the next trip into the reservation, they found a man named Charles Frush waiting for them at Lapway. Frush had been sent by Indian agent Kane to prevent them from pissing off the Nez Perce. Pierce lied his ass off, telling Frush that they were headed to the east side of the Bitterroots to prospect. Frush let them continue on, but when they again reached Wislaniqua's village, the chief presented a problem to them. The natives had heard from Agent Kane that if Pierce were to find gold, then the reservation would soon be flooded with white men. The next day, Chief Lawyer arrived to discuss the matter. But while this talk was taking place, two other white men who were probably working for the Indian agency arrived, and Pierce decided to return to Walla Walla.
They again met with Agent Kane to try to convince him to allow them to prospect on the reservation, but Kane still warned against it. Pierce gathered a large party of prospectors because safety in numbers, right? But when word arrived at Walla Walla that the non-treaty Nez Perce were preparing for armed resistance, most of the men decided they had a book club or some other affair to attend to, and so, or they had to wash their hamster instead. On August 12th, Pierce left Walla Walla once more with only six men.
Most of the narrative to this point has been from the book The Nez Perce Indians and the Opening of the Northwest by Alvin Joseph E. Jr., which is a great source of information on the Nez Perce. However, he cast some doubt on this next part. So now we're going to switch over to Byron Deffenbach, who was an Idaho historian, and his book Red Heroines of the Northwest.
According to Deffenbach, Pierce's party entered the reservation at Alapua Creek.
Alpawa Creek,
which was the westernmost edge of the reservation. They camped that night on the south side of the Snake River, but in the morning were awoken by the sounds of horse hooves around their camp. Pierce looked out to see a half dozen Nez Perce, well-mounted and well-armed. Not a word was spoken. The Nez Perce warriors just pointed back toward the Alpawa Creek, signaling to Pierce that it was time to go. He sighed and roused his camp for the trip back.
The prospectors marched back the way they came, along the Snake, until they were out of sight of the sentries, then stopped to discuss matters. They weren't ready to give up, so they camped and picked a different route the next morning. As they were coming around a particular bend, they were met by the sight of another group of Nez Perce sentries. This time, the leader spoke to Pierce, telling him word of his attempt to trespass on the reservation had spread throughout, and that they would be killed if they continued trying. They again retreated and again tried and again had the same result. And Mark, that is a hell of a neighborhood watch they had organized there.
I would say so. And you know what? They're like, we're going to kill you. And they continue to go back, you know. And then I feel like this is some of the history of this whole situation. And then they finally get killed and they're like, hey, what are they doing? You know, it's like they kept saying, yeah, we're going to kill you. But what?
Let's send the army over there.
Yeah, right. But finally they retreated to Timothy's camp, and Pierce told the headman what happened. Around the chief's campfire, Pierce and his followers gathered, along with Timothy's family, to discuss the matter. They talked in broken English, broken Nez Perce, and a great deal of sign language. Timothy told Pierce that if he kept trying, he would either die from exposure or die from an arrow through the heart and tossed into the river. Pierce asked if there was another route he could take, and Timothy gave him one. However, he told Pierce that if he had tried it, he would end up killed and tossed in the river. So the only way he wouldn't end up killed or tossed in the river, or both, was to have a native guide.
And so Pierce asked Timothy if there was a native guide willing to take them. Timothy then summarized his actions to help the white man over his lifetime, making the point that the men of his band were being watched, so none could help him. It was then that Jane, now about 18 years old, spoke up and said, I will go with the white man. And after some more discussion, it was decided that Jane sure would go guide the prospectors.
The next morning, Pierce and his men made a big show about leaving camp and faked like they were headed back to Walla Walla. They left the trail and camped and snuck back at dawn. There, Jane was waiting with canoes to take them across the river. She took them east toward Lewiston and then on to Lapwai. She did not follow the well-established Lapwai Trail, but kept, you know, it on her right side as a guide. They crossed the Potlatch River and then went on to the north fork of the Clearwater, which is now the Dwarshak Reservoir. They then followed Orofino Creek into Canal Gulch, camping at the confluence of Orofino Creek and Canal Gulch Creek.
That night, the men caught some trout from the creeks and had a big feast. Jane cleared away the dishes as they smoked and talked about gold. Early the next morning, while the rest of the men were making plans to start prospecting, Wilbur Bassett sunk his shovel into the earth and put a scoop of it in his pan. He took it down to the creek where he washed it, revealing about 3 cents worth of gold dust.
I love that shit. She's their guide and like the most important person on that journey. And their lives depend on her, and she still got to clear away the frickin' dishes.
Right.
Isn't that hilarious? Jeez. Anyway. Modernize, Jeff, modernize. but anyway, it was this pan of gold that set off the great excitement and led to the first gold rush and permanent settlement of Idaho. The rest of the prospectors started digging holes all over the basin, finding gold in almost every pan they washed. Once they collected about $80 of gold dust and were quite satisfied with what they'd found, they headed back. Not having to be as careful as leaving, they followed Orofino Creek back to Lapwai. There, they might have noticed a man named John Silcott, the man who was hired to establish the Indian Agency out there. He was busy finally constructing the buildings which had been promised by the 1855 treaty.
Pierce Party's gold find was met with mixed reactions when they reported it at Walla Walla. Large bodies of miners were ready to enter the reservation, but they were still afraid of the Nez Perce response. Finally, in November, 60 men traveled to Canal Gulch, and 41 claims were worked at an average of 27 cents a pound. I think I messed that up earlier too, which is pretty good money. The following spring, the gold rush into the future Idaho territory began in earnest. The town of Pierce was founded in Canal Gulch, and from there, miners spread out along the Clearwater River and founded Elk City, Florence, and Warren. The following year brought them to the Boise Basin, and then on down to the Owyhees, and then later on the Coeur d'Alenes, and on, right?
Right. Timothy's camp became something of a way station for miners entering the new gold districts. Jane watched as thousands of white men entered Nez Perce lands, dug up the streams, and established permanent settlements. Jane met a man named John McBean. McBean, Jeff! And they shacked up together. John McBean was a half-breed, quote-unquote, and worked for the government as interpreter to the natives of Idaho and Oregon. Many sources will say they were married, but according to an Oregon Supreme Court case having to do with an inheritance case, it is unclear if they were actually married or not. Some witnesses said they were not married. Others reported attending their wedding in the Dalles in Oregon, or at that time, the Oregon Territory, right, Jeff?
Mm-hmm. No, Oregon State.
Oh, yeah, after 1858.
Yes.
59.
49.
Hey, okay.
58.
Okay. But despite if they were married or not, they did breed together, Jeff. They had a child in common, Willie or William McBean.
John Bean's sister reported that they weren't married, that he did not want to marry Jane, and that he was married to another Native woman at this time. So I'm going to go ahead and lean toward that they weren't married. This relationship lasted for about a year, from 1857 to 1858. After that ended, Jane lived with other men for periods of time, but according to witnesses in that court case, she was not considered lewd or immoral for living with these different men. Quick note on John McBean. He's kind of an interesting character, too. Maybe we can cover him someday. He did a lot of interpretation work for the government at the time. But he would actually go on. There's some sources that say that when that they were married and that he died, and then that's when she left and then went on to the next part of her life. But actually, they were only together for that year, like you just said. But John McBean actually died on the shitter. I think. Did you?
He had some bad McBeans.
Yeah. But I think it was out the Dalles or maybe one of the forts in Oregon. But yeah, he died. The article actually says he died in the water closet, but you know what that means, right?
Oh, right. Man, that's a... But anyway, sorry, Jeff. What else were you saying there, pal?
Oh, I was just going to say he went out like Elvis, but...
Oh, yeah, that's right. Peanut butter banana sandwiches. One too many of those, right?
Right.
But around 1866, Jane was living with John Silcott, the man who built the Indian Agency at Lapwai. Jane would take his last name, so even if they never took their vows, they were considered married. What, a common law kind of thing?
Yeah, and that's another thing. There was one source that said that they were married, and actually married at Lapwai by Reverend Spaulding. So, again, like this, there's a lot of confusing and conflicting information in this one.
Yeah, man. Love is love is love, buddy. They got it on. In the eyes of God, are they not married? I don't know.
I don't know.
But Jane and John ran a ferry in Lewiston after that, and Jane took her land allotment of 168 acres under the Dawes Act, which is kind of complex, is it not, Jeff? But we'll talk about that someday.
I have.
But we talked more about that on the lynching of Peter Malick episode, one of our earlier episodes. And Her land was north of Highway 95, where between Winchester and Craigmont. Ooh, my wife lived in Craigmont as a youngin. Yeah. She was born in Cottonwood by the nuns up there. They birthed her.
So wild.
Right where that's where the little doggy hotel is when you pass by it. You know, it looks like a dog. And, yeah. Right, the beagle. The beagle. Yep. But I digress.
All right. So, Mark, this is where things start to get a little weird. Okay, you ready for this?
Excellent. Yes.
All right, so Sacagawea, or Sacagawea, I think is how she would have pronounced it. You know, that lovely lady who guided Lewis and Clark? Well, some believe that she died at Fort Manuel Lisa in North Dakota in 1812 from, quote, putrid fever. However, others believe that she actually returned to live with her own people on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming and died there in 1884, which that's 1812 or 1884. That's a big spread of time to have died, you know?
I'm pretty sure that's bullshit.
Which one?
I don't think she would have died in 1884. How old was she when she led Lewis and Clark?
She was only like 16 or younger. She's really young.
Okay, but that would still make her super old. But, you know, things happened back then. People lived really long, I guess. So who knows?
I don't have really time to get into all the details of both accounts of her death. But an article in the Idaho Statesman from December 5th, 1937, reinforces the 1884 death date theory. According to Miss Pauline Evans, who then owned the old Spalding cabin at Lapway, Timothy had heard that Sacagawea was living in Wyoming and sent Jane there to see her. Jane made Sacagawea a beautiful beaded buckskin dress that Sacagawea said that she wanted to be buried in, and in return, Sacagawea gave Jane the dress she wore during the Corps of Discovery expedition, as well as some white beads given to her by Lewis and Clark.
And here's where it gets tragic and still weirder. Jane Silcott died on January 17, 1895, according to one source. This was on her 53rd birthday. That afternoon, Jane had gone to town and then returned home around 7 p.m. She hadn't been feeling well for a few days. When John returned around 3 a.m., he found Jane on the floor in their bedroom. In the dark, he picked her up and put her in bed. From the Columbia Twice a Week Chronicle, and here's a quote, he then retired to bed himself, Mrs. Silcott for some time after carrying on a mumbling conversation. But realizing the condition of his wife that evening before, Mr. Silcott paid little heed to it because she had already been sick and probably mumbling things that people with a fever, right, do.
Yeah, exactly. But John awoke around 8 o'clock in the morning to realize that Jane was dead in bed next to him. The coroner's inquest found that as she was preparing for bed, her dress caught fire on the open hearth, and she died as a result of the burns. They found scratch marks on the inside of the door, indicating that she had attempted to escape from the room before falling, where she was later found by John.
I mean, he had to be drunk or something. Like, how do you not know? Hey, I don't know. Long ago, you know. But
it was dark. I mean, probably used to it smelling like fire if there was an open hearth in the room, and. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, no, yeah. But to honor her, John selected a site overlooking the Clearwater River for her burial. He placed a large granite marker with her name on it and the words "Never Forgotten." And John was buried beside her soon after in 1902.
Sadly, that's not quite the end of Jane's story and not the end of the weirdness. On November 24th, 1956, it was found that the Silcott's grave had been disturbed. Someone had dug down and removed Jane's mahogany casket. The casket and her body were never found. According to Wade Keene of the Sons of the American Revolution, quote, the digging looked like it had been done by an expert. And the only theory was that someone was looking for artifacts and, you know, probably some kind of a collector. So, Mark, that's Jane Silcott's story. Now let's talk a bit about her legacy. So why don't we circle back around to that article that you read at the top and talk about why it might have said that she turned the tide of the Civil War. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's probably one of other elements that were important in changing, or at least I'd say after Gettysburg, especially keeping the Union on the trajectory towards victory. They still needed money. It wasn't that the South, you know, lost at Gettysburg and then the war was over. It took a hit by all means, but there were still battles to come, right? Vicksburg was going on, right? That ended around the same time, if I do recall correctly. But they still had the Wilderness to be fought. There was Petersburg. There were conflicts going out in the West still, right? I don't remember when Chickamauga was fought. Wasn't that 1863 or 4? But you still have active combat and lots of going on. So they still needed lots and lots of money. And so, yeah, I definitely think that she played her part probably more than even your average soldier. I mean, she kept she discovered this gold or helped them discover it. So I say that's valid.
That's the thing. Like the author of that article is saying that because she helped find the gold, the Union was able to get the money they needed to finish out the war. And yeah, definitely valid. If it hadn't been for her at that time and not for Pierce at that time and Wilbur Bassett at that time, it would have been probably someone else within the next year or so. You know, it was an inevitable thing that would have happened. It just happened to be when it happened, right?
Yeah, and so she was a Nez Pierce, right? So I asked, like, it's kind of a crazy thing. It's like, so by fucking over the Nez Pierce, Pierce and all his cronies really helped at least keep the momentum going for the Union and save America in some ways. And why did she was part of this dispute that, like, I want to help the white man and the gold seekers. And so she helped because her father's band was pro, you know, America and settlement. Is that why she did it? Do we know?
Yeah, we talked about her father, Timothy, and how he helped Colonel Steptoe and helped the Spauldings, and how his father, Old Joseph, helped Lewis and Clark from starving to death. So
yeah, right.
Yeah, and I think some of the Nez Perce actually saw some value in the agriculture and other things that the white man were bringing. That was there's a flip side to that, a very dangerous, deadly flip side to it, that maybe they didn't see at the time, but they definitely, you know, tried to take advantage of what they could at the time.
Well, we both know that old Chief Joseph later became adamantly opposed to white settlement. And so his son, yeah.
Yeah, and young Chief Joseph. And that's the thing, like, this kind of family tree I'm very confused on. I saw different things. So, like, I saw that both young Joseph and Timothy were both old Joseph's sons, but I never saw them referred to as brothers. So I'm kind of confused on that.
Well, there was also the war leader of the young warriors, Olicott, and he got killed at the Battle of, it wasn't Big Hole, but it was Bear. What was it? The last Bear Paw.
Bear Paw, yeah.
And, you know, so it's like, I know that he had, I thought, at least two sons, but I do recall him having another one. But I just know that that last treaty that came about, that eventually led to the Nez Perce running, was this greatly reduced swath of land. And that five bands that ended up running were like, well, when can we believe that they're actually going to live up to their word and give us our land? Right. And it had never happened.
So that first treaty, like I said, it was signed by all 56 bands, but that last treaty was only signed by the bands that were within the existing reservation anyway. Bands that were outside of that reservation, those are the ones that were
right,
gonna fight.
Yeah.
Right. So
and there was another treaty coming that they would not sign because as Joseph and Looking Glass and the other leaders, they were like, no, we had already not signed a treaty, so we were never privy to that treaty. And then General Howard was like at first, like, no, that doesn't make sense. They aren't under the treaty, but then he changed his mind and then they went on this great attack, right?
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, yeah, it's a complex situation, isn't it?
Yeah, it always is complex. We'll talk more about General Howard because he kind of plays into a lot of the conflicts with the natives at the time. definitely an interesting military man because, yeah, he did lead the Nez Perce War, but he was very hesitant to because he saw the folly in it and he saw what was happening to the Nez Perce, but he had his orders and he was getting pressured from the white settlers.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is interesting and we'll definitely get into that someday, but lots of key, you know, unique personalities, different views on combating the Nez Perce and not always like, let's go get him, but yeah, orders are orders. And so.
Yeah. So one more thing, Mark, about Jane Silcott's legacy. There are some people, you know, those historian types that don't think Jane Silcott was the guide for the Perce Party. The Alvin Josephy book that I mentioned at the top of the episode said it wasn't her, and that the rumor that it was her had started the year after the gold find. And then Leonard Arrington, in his book, The History of Idaho, he says something similar. And they don't really say this explicitly, but I think what they are basing this off of is the fact that Perce wrote a journal of his adventures, which was later published as The Chronicles of Perce. And in that book, he says that they had a native guide, but does not mention that guide by name. He also didn't mention that it was Wilbur Bassett who panned the gold that actually started the excitement. So, you know, it's kind of hard to say. Mark, do you think there's a reason that Perce wouldn't have mentioned Jane by name if it was her?
Well, first off, I know I've heard that Wilbur Bassett was quite a hound with the ladies and the gold. Right, Jeff? That's a bad one, isn't it?
Terrible.
Maybe it was because she was a lady. Maybe he didn't want to be like we were led over by a lady. I don't know. Why do you think?
So that might be part of it, a little sexism and racism, right?
Right, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe I need to play devil's advocate here. Maybe I need to give Perce the benefit of the doubt and say that maybe he didn't mention her by name because he knew that she might become a target of those anti-treaty bands of Native Americans, of Nez Perce.
That's a good point. Maybe that's true. I don't know.
Yeah, because she actually did receive blame for what she did by some of those bands. There was some talk of actually killing her for a short period of time. And so maybe Perce did that to maybe keep her name out of it to help protect her. We don't know. And then about not mentioning that Wilbur Bassett panned the first pan of gold, that is kind of convoluted to me because Perce had already himself panned on the Nez Perce Reservation and found gold before Wilbur Bassett did. And Perce was really the one that pushed to get into the reservation to mine that gold anyway. So, you know, it's one of those things. I don't know. What do you think, Mark?
I don't know, but I think Jane Silcott, I know that the Nez Perce understood and knew of, to some degree, what happened to the Sioux, the Lakota. They knew about the fight in the Greasy Grass, or Custer's Last Stand, as we more, at least us white people, know more, the battle by. They knew what happened, and I think I know that they knew of the gold discoveries that had been made, and perhaps she was thinking, well, this is inevitable. And, you know, maybe she just thought, I'm going to help, you know, my father's vision come true, and we're going to help the white men that come into our area. Maybe she'd had great experiences with them before. I don't know. You know, who knows? But, you know,
she grew up partly on the Spalding mission. So, right. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, in complicated times, like some say now, we all have to do what we think is the best, you know, even if others view you as completely asinine and wrong, you know, but our actions might be for what we think are the best for our family, friends, people, area, community, country, etc. And so, you know, she probably thought she was doing the right thing.
Yeah, definitely agree. Definitely an interesting thing to think about. And the other thing, Mark, I was going to ask you this question. Since you're the trained historian here, when we have these conflicting sources on stories like this, what do you do? What do we do to kind of suss out the truth from these conflicting details? What do you think?
Well, when you're doing something like a podcast, right, you just mentioned that there are conflicting sources, and this is what they have to say, which you did. And then, you know, if people want to look into other arguments, they certainly can. Now, if you were like trying to go further into it as like a academic piece of history, you would kind of engage in at least a survey of like a historiography, where you kind of look at the whole slew of secondary material that's been put out there. And you see what the leading historians on the subject feel, and then you see what sources they're using, and you try to kind of like get a borderline or an idea of what the consensus is and why it's the consensus.
Definitely. And I did find a one of those oral histories that's written down. I don't know what you call that.
A transcript?
Yeah, it's like a journal. Anyway, it was I would call it a primary source because the guy was there on the ground at the time.
Oh, for sure.
Not part of the Pierce party per se, but he was one of the early miners into the area. He said that it was Jane that led the Pierce party. However, that quote from the Josephy book that says that the rumor started the next year kind of might refute that, right? So maybe that was just repeating the rumors that he had heard at the time. So even though it's a primary source, it's still might not be as reliable as we want it to be.
Right. You know, that's why Western history is so fascinating, because you're going to always get, usually you're going to have interactions with some sort of indigenous tribe, Native Americans, and then the white men. And different white men from different, avenues, like miners and agriculturalists and, politicians and bankers and et cetera. So they all have their own biases, as do the members of whatever tribe we're talking about. And so, like, when you're talking about these primary sources, like letters or recollections, a lot of times they happen way after the fact. Like, that's why people are so interested in the Battle of the Little Bighorn, Custer's Last Stand, the Greasy Grass. Because there's so many different recollections and there's so many different ways people saw it based on their own biases. You know, sometimes that's why history is, it's a scientific process, a social science, in the sense that you try to find the best sources to kind of add up to your overall thesis statement or hypothesis, but you're still shooting in the dark, right? All you can really say is what evidence we have leads us as historians to believe this was the overall way the battle went down, and this is its effect on American history, tribal history, etc. You're never going to get, you can say the battle happened on this day, this was the gun they were using, but like, why were they using the gun? What were the machinations for them using the gun? How many men would have died, etc., etc.? And in this last stand, this great epic flight of the Nez Perce, the last stand of the different bands of the Sioux. Why was it a great victory? It was their last great victory. And why is that? Why couldn't they win the fight? And so that's history. You know, these big questions that you can never really answer in one book, but you can push the ball forward in trying to understand the story of these people and these events.
Excellent answer, Mark. Thank you. So speaking of kind of mysterious, crazy events from the past, we're going to talk about that next week. Mark, what are we talking about next week?
We are talking about Jefferson Stanifer, a knight of the golden circle. What am I thinking of?
Circle.
Yeah, right. And I'm reading that book right now, your second edition, and I really like it. It has great source material. It flows. I'm enjoying it. And I like, the best thing is like, I have to talk about this point with Jeff. You know, that's the best historian part, is like, we're going to rabble over some things, but in the end it's all great, because the reason we work, Jeff, is because we talk about history in a polite manner and we come to some sort of consensus at the end, and we all come out of that rabble with a clear understanding, I think, of the cataclysmic event of the Civil War in this case, the founding of Idaho, the gold fields of the West, you know, all sorts of stuff in Jeff's story of Jeff Jefferson.
Right.
It's a really unique story. It's got covert action out West during the Civil War, you know, these spy societies. It's got all the controversy of the Civil War, but it's got that whole great, interesting unknown of what it was like on the Western coast of the United States. And it was going on here too. And I just find that fascinating.
I'm blushing just a little bit, Mark. Thank you. That's a great description of my book. But yeah, we're going to be talking about Jeff Stanifer. I wrote the book called Brave as a Lion, Jeff Stanifer and the Knights of the Golden Circle. So Mark is reading that right now. And then we're going to, like you said, we're going to tussle over it. I'm going to get all oiled up and I'm going to look crazy next week.
Oh, Jeff, you and your oils.
All right. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
All right, buddy.
Bye.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's Counting.